This is The Health Show, a presentation of National Productions.
Unintended consequences. That's what seems to be happening to a number of morbidly obese patients who get bariatric surgery and end up developing problems with alcohol abuse.
By the second postoperative year, 10.7% reported symptoms of alcohol use disorder.
On today's Health Show, we'll talk to the lead author of a study on the topic and find out if there's any real relationship between weight loss surgery and alcohol use disorders.
We'll also learn about a company called A Place for Mom that helps caregivers around the country find the right place for an elder relative in need of special care. I'm Dr. Nina Sachs.
I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Health Show. For morbidly obese people who have tried everything to lose weight without success, bariatric surgery can seem like a miracle cure. We've all seen the before and after pictures of people who've experienced massive weight loss after the surgery, and we've heard a little bit about some of the side effects. One side effect recently got a bit more attention after a report in the Journal of the American Medical Association. The report notes that a significant number of bariatric surgery patients develop alcohol use disorders. Here to talk about the report is its lead author, Dr. Wendy King, an assistant professor of epidemiology at the University of Pittsburgh Graduate School of Public Health. We spoke recently, and I asked her why the study was begun.
Well, there have been anecdotal reports that bariatric surgery may increase the risk of alcohol use disorder. And there have been several pharmacokinetic studies in Roux-en-Y gastric bypass patients showing that after surgery they experience alcohol differently. But there had really been no studies that had actually shown that bariatric surgery increases the risk of alcohol use disorder, so it was a question that needed to be addressed.
And did you find that it's, I just asked you what you did find. What were the conclusions that you came to?
Well, we performed an observational study in which 70% of the participants underwent the Roux-en-Y gastric bypass procedure. And in those participants, 7% reported symptoms of alcohol use disorder prior to surgery. In the first year after surgery, there was not a significant increase, but by the second postoperative year, 10.7% reported symptoms of alcohol use disorder, which is a relative increase of 50%. So one of the main findings was that there was, in fact, an increase in alcohol use disorder following the Roux-en-Y gastric bypass procedure. What may seem surprising is that it wasn't until the second postoperative year, and we also looked at alcohol consumption and found that alcohol consumption was reduced in the first year after surgery, and then participants resumed to their preoperative levels by the second year. So maybe the increase in sensitivity to alcohol following the Roux-en-Y gastric bypass, coupled with the return to pre-surgical drinking levels in the second year, that led to the increase in alcohol use disorder symptoms.
Had it previously been determined that alcohol does affect a patient more after bariatric surgery?
Yes. So there have been four studies where they either compared patients pre- and post-surgery or post-surgical patients to similar weight control patients, and they've given them a standard amount of alcohol and found that they reach a peak alcohol level that's higher, and they reach that peak much more quickly. It also takes them longer to return to a sober state, although the duration of time they feel that high peak is quite short. So definitely there was evidence that they experience alcohol differently. It was just kind of the step of whether that actually increases alcohol use disorder or not that needed to be addressed.
Now, what is the speculation as to the cause of this? Is it that if alcohol affects you stronger, you're more likely to become addicted?
Well, that's a really good question that we still have. So, you know, the evidence is there it affects them differently. The evidence is there that they decrease their alcohol intake initially after surgery, but then go back to preoperative drinking levels. And the question is why? Is it that in the first year they were very precautious and following maybe surgeons' advice to reduce their alcohol consumption? Is it that, you know, once they were done with the rapid weight loss phase, they thought it was safer to return to higher levels of drinking? Or is it actually that due to the experience they had with alcohol, they were driven to drink more? And we don't know the answer to that question.
You also found out with different types of bariatric surgery, there was more or less an effect on this. What were the different types?
So the Roux-en-Y gastric bypass procedure, which is the procedure that 70% of our participants underwent, is where you take the stomach and turn it into a small pouch and bypass much of the intestines. So alcohol spends less time in the stomach where it's metabolized by alcohol dehydrogenase, and then it's absorbed much more quickly. We also looked at the laparoscopic adjustable gastric banding procedure. That was done in 25% of our participants, and simply an adjustable band is put around the stomach for that procedure, so there's much fewer changes to the anatomy and physiology. And there have not been any pharmacokinetic studies done with that procedure, probably because there's less of a reason to think that that procedure would change the way alcohol is experienced. But we looked at patients that had that procedure and found no significant difference in prevalence of alcohol use disorder symptoms pre or post-surgery.
I guess the obvious question is, are people just substituting one addiction for another, going from food to alcohol?
So that idea has been thrown around a lot in the media, but there's really not a lot of good evidence to back it up yet. We have two reasons that our study did not support that hypothesis. The first is that we found a difference in Roux-en-Y gastric bypass patients, but we did it in banding patients. So if it was really this idea of addiction transfer, you know, trading in a food addiction for an alcohol addiction, you wouldn't necessarily think it would be surgical procedure specific. The other thing is we measured binge eating disorder prior to surgery. And so binge eating disorder is where people consume a large amount of food in a short amount of time with a loss of control over their eating and a feeling of guilt associated with their eating. And we looked at whether those that endorsed binge eating were more likely to develop alcohol use disorder postoperatively, and they were not. So we can't rule out that it doesn't exist, and certainly there are people that believe it does, but our study doesn't back up this idea of a shifting addictions or addiction transfer.
Did you find any difference between age and gender?
We did. So we looked at what factors we can measure preoperatively to determine who's at higher risk of having postoperative alcohol use disorder. And males and younger adults were, which is very much in line with what you'd find in the general population. More males and younger adults do experience alcohol use disorder. We also found that patients that reported less social support, having a lower sense of belonging and people to do things with, had an increased risk of postoperative alcohol use disorder. In addition, having many different measures of substance use prior to surgery were predictive. So smokers, people that drank regularly, not necessarily with problems associated with their drinking, but just drank at least twice a week, people that did have symptoms of alcohol use disorder prior to surgery, and people that reported recreational drug use were all at increased risk of having postoperative alcohol use disorders, along with having the Roux-en-Y gastric bypass procedure. And so all of those factors were independent predictors, meaning they were in a multivariable analysis where we controlled for all of the other factors.
Did it seem that family history was any kind of a predictor on that also?
We really wish we'd been able to look at that. That's a limitation to our study, that we didn't measure family history, and we also didn't measure lifetime history. So we only assessed alcohol use disorder symptoms in youth in the year prior to surgery, the first year after surgery, and then the second year after surgery. So we had, you know, 3 1-year time points. It would have been very nice to know whether those that had postoperative alcohol use disorder that didn't have it in the first year prior to surgery, maybe they were still just in remission at time of surgery and had had symptoms in the past, and we can't answer that question. But prior studies suggest that having a lifetime history with remission at time of surgery is a risk factor.
Are there education programs going on for surgical patients, either pre- or post-surgery or both?
Yes. The problem right now, perhaps, is that there aren't very firm guidelines and standard of care on exactly how alcohol should be screened and assessed and dealt with. But definitely there's already the recommendation out there that patients that have current alcohol use disorder are not good surgical candidates. And some centers can choose how they deal with that, whether they just simply refer the patients on to get help and kind of they're out of the bariatric surgical loop, or whether they actually, you know, really try to get them help and follow through with them to help them perhaps become good surgical candidates in the future. But in terms of how much education is done, I think there's probably a lot of variation. And I know that some surgeons are very concerned about this and probably already doing everything they can. And at other places, maybe there's quite a bit more that can be done. I think the big message here is that education needs to not just be during the preoperative period, but also continuously done in the postoperative follow-ups. You know, people need to hear information when they're ready to hear it and when it's applicable to them. So if they're not having any problems with alcohol prior to surgery, they may not take the recommendations quite as seriously. Postoperatively, if they start to have some problems, that might be a time that really they need to hear more of the information and advice and have more potential for referral to counseling or to treatment options. Another big finding of the study was if you look at alcohol consumption in the second postoperative year, irrespective if it was associated with any problems, just looking at how much people drank, 1 in 8 patients, and this is with both the banding and the bypass procedure, reported drinking at least 3 drinks per typical drinking occasion. So that level of drinking may be associated with problems with liver function and nutritional status after the surgery, and may also get in the way of their weight loss goals. So I think the education needs to do with, you know, risk of alcohol use disorder, which is abuse and dependence, as well as just risk of heavy drinking and how that may hurt their health.
Well, looking ahead, I mean, we're only getting bigger in America, so this surgery is going to become more common. Do you think down the road we'll be seeing more unintended consequences of this surgery? Is there a lot we still have to learn about what's going to happen?
Certainly there's a lot that needs to be learned. The American Society for Metabolic and Bariatric Surgery is very dedicated to determine all the risks and benefits of surgery and take reducing risks very, very seriously. They want the best outcomes for their patients, and they want the best health for their patients. So I think that with any procedure that's relatively new, even though we still have a lot to learn, that there's more to learn. But there's definitely researchers that are devoted to studying the surgery and what different outcomes there are, both good and bad, in the short term and the long term. One need there is to look at, you know, alcohol use disorders in the third, fourth, fifth postoperative year, because right now that long-term data doesn't exist. This study, the longitudinal assessment of bariatric surgery, where we measured alcohol use at each year in this report, is ongoing, and so we will be able to report on longer outcomes in the future.
Dr. Wendy King is an assistant professor of epidemiology at the University of Pittsburgh Graduate School of Public Health. Her report can be seen in the June 20th issue of the Journal of the American Medical Association.
Still to come, finding a place for an elderly parent takes more than the yellow pages. That's next on The Health Show.
You can find The Health Show anytime online at healthshow.org. Search the archive and listen to whole programs you may have missed or would like to hear again. Even subscribe to our podcast. That's healthshow.org. You can also follow us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/thehealthshow.
You can start your own Health Show archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for Health Show number 1268.
This is The Health Show. I'm Bob Barrett.
And I'm Dr. Nina Sachs. For over a decade, a company called A Place for Mom has been helping seniors and their families find the best senior living options for their situation. From independent and residential assisted living communities to Alzheimer's and dementia memory care facilities, their advisors help guide the search, providing local support and resources and empowering families to make informed decisions each step of the way. The Health Show's Joe Donahue recently learned more about A Place for Mom by speaking to a pair of their spokespersons. Joan London is the former longtime host of ABC TV's Good Morning America, a best-selling author and women's health advocate. London is a working mother of seven, including two sets of twins, and is also caregiver to her 93-year-old mother. Amy Bryant is a representative of A Place for Mom in Albany, New York. Joe started by asking London why she believes this organization is special.
You know, I lived this. You know, I have taken care of my mom as well as my brother since really I was in my 30s, my early 30s, when I took over the care of them. My brother had diabetes and just had all kinds of complications and really couldn't hold a job. And so I put the two of them together, and they, you know, lived their life kind of helping each other out. And I always paid the bills, but I wasn't around taking care of the everyday tasks. So when my brother passed away about 7 years ago, like so many other Americans, I didn't plan ahead. I didn't have a plan in place, hadn't had that discussion that none of us really want to have. And I flew out to Sacramento, California, my hometown, and there you are. You know, you're in this home. I was planning a funeral, and then I was trying to plan my mom's life. Where is she going to live? She couldn't stay in the house. She had some dementia, and I'd had a person coming in taking care of their needs kind of on a daily basis, but she couldn't stay there. And here you are, you're an adult child, and you're successful in your business, and yet you're thrown into this complex world that you don't know anything about. And the first couple times, I just drove around town, and I found her a place, and it was a fabulous place, but it was totally wrong for her. So, you know, within a few months, I was back on a plane, coming back out, looking for another place. And it wasn't until I got an elder advisor that the whole process became so much easier. You know, now when I look back on it, I think to myself, what were you thinking? lucky. And if you wanted to go buy a house, you would have gotten a real estate agent. You wouldn't have driven around looking for houses that were for sale. You know, these senior advisors, they know every bed in their area that's available, and they help you assess the needs of your parent, which is sometimes not so easy to do. When I got my mom into that first place, I kind of got my mom a great place for the mom of 20 years ago. And that's how we still think about them in our minds. And it's kind of hard for us to almost grasp how much care they need on a daily basis. So when you get an expert that just asks all these questions and assesses their needs, then it makes it much easier to decide then what kind of a facility should she or he really be in.
So, Amy Bryant, you're answering a lot of these questions. Place for Mom is this free elder care referral service. You assist families in finding resources of every kind. And when I say every kind, I mean, as you enter into this, people don't have a clue as to what they're dealing with. So it can come from how do I get cable in the nursing home, right? It's anything.
Absolutely.
And everything.
Absolutely. And oftentimes we start the conversation by saying, what prompted your search today?
Yeah.
And that gives us a good understanding, a baseline understanding of what their concerns are and what the circumstances might be.
Why is the system so hard to navigate?
Just because of all the choices that are offered, different types of payer sources. I mean, some require private pay, some are covered by Medicaid, some are covered by Medicare. Just really depends on the nature of the individual and their needs.
One other thing that's kind of involved here, and I can speak to it, there's an emotional factor. You go through so many different passages in life that seem kind of natural. You know, time comes that you move out of your house, you learn to live on your own. The time comes that you get married, you learn to live with someone. Time comes that you have a child. But I got to tell you, when the time comes, and it comes for all of us, so think ahead about this. It's an awkward transition the day that you become the parent to your parent. And you have to start telling them what they need to do. There's just nothing easy about it. There's a lot of emotion involved. In many families, you know, different ones have guilt involved or anger. And, you know, all of a sudden you have 2, 3, 4, 5 adult siblings trying to come to some kind of an agreement. They often don't live close to each other. It's a really complicated road to go down, and that emotional factor makes it even more difficult. And I got to tell you, I had an opportunity a few months ago to go and spend some time with about 100 of these A Place for Mom advisors. They are doing way more than just finding a place for your parent or your loved one to live. Because, you know, it's not just a parent. It might be your husband or your wife or a sibling or just a friend that somehow you're in charge of them. They are psychologists. They are family advisors. They need to get your whole story out so that they understand what it is you're dealing with. I really take my hat off to them because they get us at our most cranky, awkward, frustrated point in our lives.
Yeah, Amy agrees with that. she's been there.
True.
You know, you talk about the emotional aspect of this, and Joan touched on this. You have what you think is right. I've gotten the input, and this is what I think is right for Dad. Now, Dad has a different point of what he thinks is right for him. So there's a lot to juggle here, isn't there, Amy?
Absolutely. And I think there are many emotional components to this. As Joan had mentioned, guilt and, you know, sometimes denial of the situation. And I think oftentimes the key is striking a balance between what the loved one wants, what you want, and what everyone's needs are. One thing that I've found is a very common thread among families is their perception of independence and their loved one's independence. And they may start by saying, you know, oh, my dad is very independent and I'm just looking for research for the future. So I just want some options. And then we get into our discussion and it turns out that the daughter is, you know, cooking for dad, cleaning for dad, doing his laundry, taking him to places. So we double back on that and say, is he really independent or is he independent minded?
Yeah. You know? There's a big difference. I mean, if you ask my mom, she would tell you, oh, sure, I could live on my own and have the truck here tomorrow and take me back to my house.
Right.
But there's not a chance in the world. I mean, she needs every single aspect of her care from morning to night taken care of. when you walk into these homes, I will tell you, it's just not my personality type that I would go over and open up the refrigerator to see if there's fresh food in the refrigerator so I know what they're cooking, and walk into the bathrooms and walk into the bedrooms. I don't think I ever would have done that, but those are all the things that need to be done. So that's another reason why it's so important to get professional advice on this one, because they go to all of these places and they do the sniff test and they ask all the questions, and how are meds taken care of? And they find out the little nuances, just like a realtor would tell you, well, you know, you might not want to be in this school district because you have a lot of young kids. Maybe you ought to look at a home over here.
You were talking about the difference, Amy, between independent and independent-minded.
Yeah.
And our parents often have this, well, I don't need this outside help because I have my kids to take care of me and they'll always be here, without the understanding that we also have our wives, which of course makes us, the kids, feel like garbage.
Sure. And part of that is helping, enabling yourself to say it's okay to pursue care and to pursue outside help for your loved one. And it's also okay to point that out to your loved one, that I do need time for my family, and making this move will be beneficial for all of us. It's going to improve your quality of life. It's going to enable you to be more independent than you are now. You may not think so, but you will be, because you'll be able to make choices for yourself, and you won't have to wait for me to come and make your meals and wait for me to say I have time on Wednesday to take you to grocery shopping. It's helping them understand how this move or how these changes will help them have a better quality of life.
Mm.
They're in denial.
Right.
If they really were honest, they wouldn't want to burden their adult children and their families the way it does impact a family. But it's a scary thing, you know, it's scary for them. So they really fight it. Almost every one of them fights it. But you have to start this communication way before you ever think that you do. And sometimes it's hard to get the parents to join this conversation, because they look at you and say, oh, you're calling me old? You're going to send me off to a nursing home?
Right.
And there's this huge spectrum of senior housing and senior communities before you ever get to a nursing home. And there comes a time where they don't really need to be worrying about mowing the lawn and fixing the roof, and they can move into a senior community where they live with other people their age. They can go downstairs and eat dinner in a dining room, play cards at night. And if you can get this conversation started, though, seriously, it is the elephant sitting in the living room of everybody's home, and everyone knows it's there, everyone knows it's coming. But there are things you need to have in place. You need to have, you know, an advanced health care directive. That's like a living will. You don't want to have to make those decisions at a time of crisis. You need a durable power of attorney. I mean, you should be signed on your parents' bank account, because if you're not, you can't do business for them. And you can find yourself in a position of having to be in charge of the responsibility of paying for their care. Meanwhile, their Social Security checks are going into a bank account, and you can't do anything with that bank account because you're not signed on it. You know, everybody says, oh, well, we have a will in place. That's for after they're gone. It's those months or years, or listen, it could be two decades of having to take care of a parent, and you need that living will. That speaks to what their wishes are before they die.
Joan London is the former host of ABC TV's Good Morning America, a best-selling author and women's health advocate. Amy Bryant is a representative of A Place for Mom in Albany, New York.
That's all the time we have for this week's Health Show. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at healthshow.org. You can explore the archive for any programs you might have missed or would like to hear again. You can also subscribe to our podcast. That's healthshow.org.
Want more? Then follow us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/thehealthshow. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is letters@healthshow.org.
I'm Bob Barrett.
And I'm Dr. Nina Sachs.
Stay healthy and be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Health Show.
Dr. Nina Sachs is a practicing member of the American College of Gastroenterology. Bob Barrett is producer of The Health Show. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Health Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content.